its current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. If you're a Detroit Tiger fan, pardon me, Detroit Tiger fan, you might be struck by one particular contrast between last season and this one. Every season is different, right? But the one that stands out in my mind, so much of last season was spent wondering if we'd make the playoffs. I mean, it was one threat after another for a lot of last year, and in the end, ironically, it resulted in a World Series appearance. And I don't want to jinx this thing, but can you believe how much of the season we have been in the driver's seat this year? Little like last year, and last night was kind of bears that out. Tigers 9, White Sox 1. Our magic number now for making the playoffs is down to 13. Rick Porcello goes the whole game, fielder homers. We are coming off a 3-game losing streak, okay, but we did get closer to the playoffs by beating the White Sox yesterday. I believe we're in first place by 4.5 games today. Yes, it's 4.5 games. Cleveland's 4.5 back. But that's the tightest it's been in some time, if I'm not mistaken. So, anyway, one noticeable contrast, I think, between last year and this. We're glad you're here today. We hope you can stick around. We talk with modern teen novelist Holly Black later on in the show. She's in Lansing, and we remember 9/11 firefighters here in just a few. To start the show, Lansing Township's Eastwood development continues to grow. Township officials recently gave the green light to Lansing developer Mike Ide to build a $10 million Fairfield Inn and Suites near U.S. 127 and Lake Lansing Road. It's slated to open in 2015. The Fairfield would follow the scheduled opening of a nearby Hyatt Place Hotel. That would make 5 hotels in the vicinity of Eastwood. Yesterday, I spoke with Lansing Township Planning Director Stephen Hayward about all the activity. I first asked him whether hotel growth in the Eastwood area is the result of a particular situation in Lansing. There, city government has pledged not to help underwrite additional downtown hotel expansion, what many regard as a sweetheart deal for downtown's Radisson Hotel. Hayward, who is a former city official, feels that the two are not that related.
You know, I don't think it is. I think the interest is that hotel guests that come into the region have a variety of locations to choose from, and I think that's why the Convention and Visitors Bureau has been focusing on this 500 hotel rooms in an interchange philosophy for the last couple of years. And I certainly believe that there's a market for downtown Lansing, and I believe that if the issue of subsidy where the city of Lansing can't participate, certainly unfortunate. However, it doesn't preclude a hotel from being developed in downtown. It just precludes the participation by the city of Lansing in that hotel.
So there's nothing stopping a developer from building a hotel, but the current arrangement doesn't allow enough city investment to incentivize that.
Correct. If we're talking about the city of Lansing's need for a second hotel to support their efforts, the only preclusion is the city can't participate through incentives. That doesn't keep a developer from going in and borrowing the money and investing in it themselves. However, developers are going to base their decisions on where they can, you know, reliably make their return on investment. And that's one of the efforts that they're going to have to overcome in that market. I truly believe that downtown Lansing and downtown East Lansing can support second hotels. I really do. But getting the developers to invest solely in that is going to be difficult for them.
So you have no concerns about the area of Lake Lansing and 127 profitably sustaining around a total of 500 hotel rooms?
Well, you know, the best answer to that is the banks don't. You know, the people that are lending the money to the developers for these hotels are pretty sophisticated. And since the downturn in 2007, 2008 in the hotel industry, the lending for these hotels have become much more stringent and require approximately 40% equity by the developer. So for the developers to come in and invest in the for the market studies and the appraisals to come in support of a loan from these banks. That's really the kind of the proof's in the pudding. It's not, you know, the township's role to advise people if it's a good use of their funds to develop the property. It's more up to them and their own making business decisions as to is this a good location for them to invest money in hotels.
Has the township encountered any resistance to the Fairfield development?
No, we through the Planning Commission process and the Township Board, you know, there's been no opposition or no comments received from residents or businesses. And keep in mind, this is a 100% private deal. You know, this isn't subsidized, or the township through the DDA is not initiating any investment or giving any type of a tax break for this facility. So this will be a market rate deal. The developer is going out and borrowing the money and developing it on land that's already under private control.
The Fairfield project is being privately financed, as you say, but the Heights project nearby was underwritten with $22 million in township bonds, which created quite a stir at the time. How has the township's balance sheet been impacted by the public money that was invested in the Heights project? Can you update that for us?
Sure. The positive thing about when the township went out and borrowed these funds is that they made sure that they had significant reserves to kind of weather the development storm. You know, there's capitalized interest on the bond, so there wasn't a bond payment due immediately. And now that bond payments are due, we have revenue coming into the property, as well as the reserves that we can draw against. Now, drawing against revenues is not a sustainable solution. So we're in full development mode now of signing tenants. What's exciting about the Fairfield coming on board is it points to, you know, you have the Hyatt Place, which is a $15 million hotel that's privately funded and being developed as part of the Heights. You have the Vista at the Heights, which is the apartments that DTN's doing, and that's a $12 to $14 million project that's being privately funded. And then you have this Fairfield, which is $10 million. So what we're able to go to is future tenants and say, look at the, you know, nearly $40 million in private investment and those the buying power of those people, you know, nearly 250 hotel guests, nearly 250 residents of luxury apartments that will be on site to spend their money. That's impactful. That's actually helping us pick up leasing momentum of our project.
Is Eastwood and that area generally accessible by public transportation?
Yeah, it's actually, CATA approached us this last year to do, I can't recall the route number, but it, the places you can go on route, you know, XYZ, and it's kind of a Dr. Seuss takeoff. But they did a year-long campaign of trying to educate the students at Michigan State that you can get to Eastwood and other areas along the route, Meyer and Kroger and those destinations, by not driving your car. So if you're at Michigan State University, you can get to Eastwood because it has a direct route. Same thing with a direct route from the transportation center in downtown Lansing. So there's three public transit routes, the third being one that comes from Chandler Crossing areas that go directly to Eastwood. So Eastwood, compared to the Meridian Mall and the Lansing Mall, has more public transit routes than the other locations.
So you would disagree with a critic who might say that Eastwood is too reliant on people who have to drive to it?
Yeah, I definitely would. I think there's only one retail shopping district in this region that, you know, feels really connected to the rooftops around it, more so than Eastwood. Eastwood's got a great neighborhood to the south with the Grosbeck neighborhood. And we just installed the sidewalks in partnership with East Lansing across 127, so now there's a non-motorized link in that direction over to the residents that are off of Coolidge and over behind the Meyer there off of Marfitt. But, you know, Michigan Avenue and Grand River Avenue, the hub of Frandor, is better situated for being connected for non-motorized. I'll give them that. That's that's a great location. I've always been a fan of that location. I think that the Red Cedar development that's being proposed down there is fantastic. Takes advantage of that. Do I think they're in competition with one another? No. I think they're totally separate communities in this region. And I think, you know, even though they're only separated by a mile, I think they both have an attribute that benefits the region.
And what do you say to critics who maintain that we really need a more regionalized, a more vigorous regional approach to planning, that this all of this development being planned for Lansing Township is really well and good, but it doesn't take into consideration the larger area?
Well, I think that I would say that there's something about Eastwood that makes people feel uncomfortable. And I can't put my finger on it. I've been involved in regional planning and actually did the regional growth study for this community, all 78 units of government, a decade ago. And I still can't put my finger on the issue, because a hotel will open in Delta Township, and there's one opening probably next week with the Hampton Inn, brand new hotel north of Horrocks, nice walkable location to Horrocks, and, you know, that's predominantly it. And those hotels can be built in this region, just like the Holiday Inn Express was built 4 years ago over on West Street, West Road, and nobody makes a comment. And a building is developed at Eastwood, and the criticism is this should be a more regional approach. It strikes me that people unfairly judge Eastwood, that when something develops there, it's a negative, and I can't understand that. You know, most communities would embrace the fact that a shopping center with upscale attributes was developed, and it's going on its 11th year anniversary tomorrow, or actually Thursday on the 12th will be its 11th year anniversary. It's 97% full, and they're going to announce two tenants by the end of the year, and they should be 99% full. Number one theater in the state, just expanded. Number one Sam's Club in the state. Number one Max and Irma in the nation. Those kind of attributes, most people would be proud of it and use it to point to and say, look, retail can succeed and thrive. Restaurants can succeed and thrive. Hotels can thrive in this region. It doesn't have to be at Eastwood. I would say, you know, the regional approach is needed from other parties to take advantage of what Eastwood says about this community and use it to develop the Red Cedar, develop stabilize Frandor. Fill the Lansing Mall, fill the Meridian Mall. It's not unique to Eastwood, but for some reason, Eastwood has struck a chord that it's maybe it's the accessibility in the region. But if you have a good product and a good tenant, I think this region can support it.
Stephen Hayward is the Director of Planning and Development for Lansing Township. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Mark.
Today is September 11th. It's been 12 years since the horrible events in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania that saw more than 3,000 people die at the hands of terrorists. As Americans, we still feel unsettling emotions at the mere mention of the term 9/11. We remember with pride, however, the bravery of our first responders who rushed into harm's way to save lives. While we still hold police and firefighters in high regard, those professions have weathered their share of hardships in the years since. Current State's Kevin Lavery spoke this week with Mark Dougherty, the president of the Michigan Professional Firefighters Union. They met on a spot in downtown Lansing that many in the fire service might consider hallowed ground.
We are at the site of the old Kearns Hotel, which was a very premier hotel in Lansing in the old days. And in 1934, it burned to the ground in the worst fire in Lansing's history. And just a few feet to our right is a chunk of the World Trade Center. So a very fitting place to have this conversation. Tell me something about what it was like 12 years ago in the weeks and months after 9/11, the attitude the public had toward firefighters. What it was like to be a firefighter in those days?
It was a very tragic moment, but a very proud moment. We saw 343 of our guys go in to rescue people and not come out. We know that's part of our job, and we know that that's a risk we take, and we're willing to sacrifice in order to save lives. It's a proud moment for them, but also a devastating moment for our industry. At the time, the public was very appreciative of that. I think through the years, that's waned some, and people forget what you're really willing to do. And a lot of times in the fire service, we say we're not necessarily paid for what we do, we're paid for what we're willing to do. And that is the ultimate sacrifice. And those 343 did not hesitate, even though they knew that probably would be the last thing they did.
You say that public support has waned a bit in the last 12 years. Is that because firefighters perhaps are not as foremost in people's minds because the tragedy is no longer fresh? Or has it become a matter of governmental priorities and that perhaps public safety in this era of budget crunches doesn't rise to the top in the way that it used to?
I don't want to misconstrue. I don't think public support's waned as much. I mean, public appreciates what we do. We get a lot of thank yous. We get a lot of people very appreciative. The problem is public officials faced with challenges to cut budgets and to keep them getting reelected will make cuts to public safety. And sadly, too many of the public don't realize it. Their lives are busy. They continue going on. And they don't realize the cuts that their community leaders are actually making to the fire service or the police service. And those cuts can be devastating. We've seen plenty of departments across the state suffer huge reductions in staffing. 2/3 in some cases have been laid off or attritioned out. And staffing is the key component to an effective service and to the safety of our firefighters and ultimately the safety of the residents.
I think you need to look no further than Detroit. Of course, that city has its own unique set of financial problems in ways other cities in the country don't. This month, as a matter of fact, September 16th is the effective date. 400 firefighters are taking a 10% pay cut, and I don't know if it's really known what effect that will have on their pensions. I think pension funding is probably just as big an issue as anything else in the fire service.
Certainly. Almost every local we represent is taking pay cuts across the state of Michigan. Detroit's no exception. Detroit faces other challenges, being in bankruptcy. And pension issue is one that we constantly hear is a drawdown on budgets for cities. Cities for years, especially through the 90s, didn't pay anything into these pension systems, even though we recommended that they did. They took what they called pension holidays because the fund was overfunded, and we advised against it at the time. They still did it. Now when times get tough, all of a sudden these pensions are unsustainable. Before 2007, all these pensions were over 100% funded, and there was no talk of that whatsoever. Now there is, because they actually have to pay into them. But the fact is, with police and firefighters, we have to have some type of defined benefit pension, as the military has, because you can be killed on any day on the job, and you need to know that your family's taken care of. It's part of the assurance we have going to work every day and doing our job, that if something happens, our families will be taken care of. You can't die like Brian Wilkie in Westland just died in line of duty a few months ago. He had 5 months on the job. If he had a 401k, he'd have maybe $1,500 on it. That's not taking care of the family. He was pensioned out, and his family's taken care of.
Is the lack of a defined benefits pension a national problem, or is that something that's unique to Michigan firefighting units?
Unfunded liabilities for pension systems is a national problem also. It's worse now because of the last few years, but it's going to rebound. There's a lot of exaggeration on certain sides to try to erode this benefit. There's a lot of people that would like to see it gone, and they try to capitalize on that. Detroit's pension system is not as bad as they're making it out to be, but that was a way for them to try to address it and get rid of it.
Your union represents about 5,000 firefighters. In Wisconsin, we've seen in recent years, public employees have had their collective bargaining rights stripped away from them, and they're being required to pay more in their pensions and benefits. For the most part, public safety officials were unscathed, but I think now, even in Wisconsin, there is talk of targeting firefighters for the same restrictions. How closely are you watching that in Michigan, and what could the writing be on the wall for what may happen here on our side of the lake?
There's a lot of differences between us and Wisconsin. We the legislature here still believes collective bargaining is a valid tool, especially for police and fire. The number one thing we bargain is the safety of our members, in addition to paying benefits. But those paying benefits support the firefighters there, and like I said, for disability reasons, death. So it's still important. I don't see this legislature embracing eliminating collective bargaining rights for police or fire or any public employees. They've made some changes, but the overall aspect, I think, is going to remain here, and the ability to collectively bargain.
We've also seen across the country trends in consolidating municipal or county-level police and fire services. I know that's happened to a large extent in Metro Detroit, other places in Michigan. I've heard firefighters say we have to cover a lot of ground with very few people. Sometimes it's difficult for us to get to a fire that might be 10, 12 miles away. Is consolidation alleviating any of that?
There's a lot of talk on regionalization and consolidation of municipalities, particularly fire departments. We support that concept because what we ultimately want to have are what we call boots on the ground. We want firefighters on the street. When you have several small communities side by side each other, they all have administrations, they all have chiefs, they all have payroll, they all have training divisions, fire marshals, and you can reduce that redundancy and get those people out on the street and provide better services. So that's something that we believe needs to happen and is happening. We've got very successful consolidation in the Wayne Westland area, Dearborn, Melvindale, and we've got approximately 24 other communities talking about consolidating to include the Lansing area.
Another issue that your union is working on is cancer presumption. By that I mean most states in the country recognize that if a firefighter is diagnosed with cancer, it is presumed that it's work-related, unless that person has been a heavy smoker or a tobacco user for the previous 10 years. Michigan has something similar with heart and respiratory ailments, but not with cancer. What progress is being made on that front right now?
We have a bill introduced that was actually passed out of committee in the Senate that it will do that, will provide cancer presumption for firefighters. Now, this isn't all cancers. This is limited to 10 different cancers that have been proven to be associated with exposure on fire grounds. What a lot of people don't understand are firefighters are exposed to cancer or carcinogens on every fire they go in. There's no protective equipment that can protect you from that exposure. We wear very good equipment, but it still permeates your skin and gets in your system. This has been proven. Nobody argues that fact anymore that we're not exposed to it. It's now time, though, to take care of our firefighters who are subject to being disabled or killed because of these cancers. We need the presumption because you can't point to a particular fire to say that fire caused this cancer. It's a cumulative thing. Cancer, as everybody knows, is accumulation of exposure to carcinogens that someday may come out. And there's no way to prove it without a presumption, same as a heart presumption for heart attacks.
With all these issues that we've talked about today, Mark, on this 12th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, what would you really like to have resonate in the public's mind about what you and your colleagues in the fire service do and the needs that you have?
I want them to understand, first of all, on this anniversary is to never forget. That's our motto with this. Never forget the 343 that died. One thing I want to add is there's 55 more firefighters from just the City of New York Fire Department alone that have passed away since 9/11 due to exposure on that day. Those guys are the same heroes as the guys that passed away that day. They were exposed to the carcinogens down there, and they developed cancers and stuff and have died. There's actually even more people exposed when you talk about construction workers and other people who helped out on the scenes, different trades. And those estimates are very high. Want people to remember those, but we also remember the job we do and the importance of it. Pay attention in your community as to staffing issues. Understand what they're doing if they're laying off, what that means to you. If they're closing fire stations, that's going to be increased response times, and the longer it takes us to get there, the more unsafe you are.
Mark Dougherty is the president of the Michigan Professional Firefighters Union. Thanks for talking with us today.
No problem. Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
It's Wednesday and time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week we feature the Women's Center of Greater Lansing. The nonprofit offers a variety of services, including counseling, employment assistance, even auto maintenance classes for women in the Lansing area. And Cindy Allwood is the executive director of the Women's Center, and she joins me now. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Auto maintenance classes. That has got my curiosity all revved up. Tell us about your programs that you offer.
Well, the Cars 101, we try to offer twice a year for winter driving. And then
Cars
again,
101?
Yep, it's called
Sounds
Cars 101.
Like a radio station.
Yeah. for winter driving and then in summer driving. We do this in conjunction with Brogan's Tire service.
Brogan's Lansing Tire Center.
Yes. Yeah, and they've been wonderful. And anybody can come to this class.
Is it popular?
Yeah.
That one?
Yeah, it is. It's a little bit different now. We've been offering it since, maybe the first year. We just turned 8. So it's been over 7 or so years. And cars have changed quite a bit in that time.
Yes.
And so the computer situation, things are kind of still where they always were, like you need to know where to change your oil and how to check your oil and all that kind of thing. And it's really for people who don't know anything about their car but who need to know some of the basics. Like, where is your spare tire? I drive a van, and my spare tire is underneath. You can't find it from inside. So I didn't know that.
What about your other programs besides that? That one jumped out
at me. Oh, okay. All right.
But what are the other most in-demand programs that you offer?
I would say probably our workshops range from assertiveness training to grief, dealing with grief. Mm. Grief is the number one issue that is reported by women who come to the Women's Center.
How so?
Losing a job, losing a relationship. Many, many women come in who've worked for organizations for 15, 20 years. So their lives revolve around their work friends, their work family. And when they're downsized out or they leave or even when they retire, it's something that they wanted, but things have changed dramatically.
Huge transition.
New transition, and you've been doing the same thing 50 weeks out of the year for 15 years, and all of a sudden, what do I do?
Is that a real common pattern then? Somebody who has lost something, job, relationship, they're transitioning to retirement, something like that.
Yep.
Can you describe in greater detail what economic abuse is? How does that unfold?
Economic abuse is when one person in the relationship controls the money, the credit, all of those things to the detriment of the other person.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, usually the woman is required to give over her paycheck or any other income that she gets. Her partner may decide, I'm going to do such and such with this money, or I'm going to go buy a car, but I'm going to use her Social Security number and her credit and all of that, and then they don't make the payments on the loan. So her credit is destroyed, which means it's going to be really hard for her to leave that relationship because she's not going to be able to find a place to live, and she doesn't have access to resources, financial resources necessarily, if he controls all the money.
And this is kind of where the auto maintenance comes in. The auto maintenance offers some independence,
right?
And makes the woman less reliant on the man if that's the way this is playing out.
Right.
Okay, so she becomes empowered, basically.
Right.
How do women find you or learn about your group?
All different sorts of ways. We get a lot of referrals from other agencies who can't serve the person for whatever reason. We advertise a lot of our things in the newspapers, and I do a couple of different radio shows and talk about the work that we're doing. And so we get referrals. We get people who just come by. They wonder what it is. They look at our website. They're looking for resources, and our name pops up on Google, which is really cool because we're in the number one spot for Women's Center Lansing.
That's good.
Yes, it took us a while to get there.
Is there a story or two that captures why you do the work you do?
I have a couple. I've been thinking about this for a few days. The very first client that we had ended up using four different services that we offer. She was referred by a center in Ann Arbor because she couldn't find us at the time. So she had called down there, and they said, come to the Women's Center. You know, there's a Women's Center in Lansing. Come over. She had her husband had just left her with two kids and no job, and she happened to be a person who was here. He had a green card, but she didn't because he was in school.
Mm-hmm.
And so there wasn't a lot of services available to her, and she'd been providing she was basically doing caregiving and child care and all of that for him while he finished his PhD program. And then she finds herself without income, by herself with two kids.
How was she most helped by? What are the four areas that she pursued? Do you remember?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I worked with her.
Oh, okay.
Because I was the only one there at the time.
Oh, you were the Women's Center.
Yeah, exactly, okay. Exactly. So what we did was first deal with the grief and the loss of the relationship, and we found some local resources for her.
The emotional
dimension. Yes, we dealt with the emotional piece, trying to sort of get her back on her feet. We were able to get her into a program where she could get some short-term training and get a skill.
Okay.
And so she was able to bring income into the family and take care of her children. She actually helped us do a couple of fundraisers. And she was an amazing cook. So we had a couple of fundraising where she could showcase her cooking skills, and we raised some money with that.
Nice.
And then she went into the divorce group. We have a group called Not So Happy Endings. And she got some emotional support and some other resources in that group. And then she decided she needed to go and get an education, her own education. So we hooked her up with Lansing Community College through the Women's Resource Center there. And she just completed a master's program in social work.
How about that? So the emotional piece,
mm-hmm.
job training,
mm-hmm.
divorce counseling, and education.
Education.
And provided all four.
And then she came back because she was having all these health issues and didn't know what was going on. So she went into our midlife journey group and realized she was probably experiencing issues with menopause. So we were able to refer her to some healthcare providers
wow.
to deal with that. And she's amazing. She is absolutely amazing.
What about the larger local landscape in terms of services for women in the Lansing area or the or Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton County?
Sure.
Do you think is it adequate? Is it inadequate?
Well, I think it's inadequate given the challenges that we are facing still with our economy. 2008 and 2009 were awful.
Yeah.
I mean, we struggled. Our clients struggled. We had women who pulled up in nice new cars but didn't have a home because they lost their home to foreclosure. Because one of the parents lost their job.
Right.
So they didn't have the income. They had children, and they couldn't make the mortgage payments and all these, you know, different scams that these mortgage places were doing. People were ending up with no home.
Right.
And nowhere to go because there's not that many shelters in this area. So they were showing up at our door, and we were doing the best that we could to help them.
Yeah. If people want to access your services, how do they go about it? And you rely on volunteers, I assume, as well.
We have we are an incubator for the helping professions, graduate students in counseling, social work, things like that. But we also use marketing and PR interns. You can find us on the internet or on the web at womenscenterofgreaterlansing.org.
Very good.
You can call 372-9163.
Very good. Cindy Allwood is the Executive Director of the Women's Center of Greater Lansing. Nice to hear your story. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you.
We could always use more nominations, and we know there are great people and organizations out there doing great work. We just don't know about them yet. If you'd like to be one featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, tweet us at @KARCurrentState. Or you can send us an email, currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Current State on WKAR, the trend of teen novels transporting their readers to fantasy worlds filled with vampires, fairies, and monsters is relevant once again with this month's release of Holly Black's latest novel, The Coldest Girl in Coal Town. The young adult author is most famous for co-writing the Spiderwick Chronicles series that was turned into a 2008 movie. Holly Black is in town tonight and tomorrow night to sign copies of her new book. She took some time yesterday to chat with us and answer a few questions from some of her loyal fans from Okemos High School. Black says she and co-author Tony DiTralisi had no expectation that the Spiderwick Chronicles would become as popular as they are.
You know, Tony and I, we both really loved fairy folklore and fairy tales, and it was a great project for us to work on. We'd been friends for a long time. But, you know, I kind of thought of things I like as not necessarily being the things that everybody else likes. So it was a real surprise that a lot of people did really love the books. And you know, and it was a delight because people then went out into their backyards as we intended and looked for evidence of fairies and sometimes found it and told us about it.
Your latest book is called The Coldest Girl in Coal Town. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Absolutely. It is part road trip. It is part an exploration of a dangerous and debaucherous city and mostly about a girl discovering her own inner monstrousness and coming to kind of love it.
Sounds promising. How did you become a fantasy writer? How did this career of yours unfold?
Well, I'd always loved reading, and I thought that being a writer would be great because I could, you know, both make books a thing that I really loved and get to hang out with writers. And for the most part, that seems to have worked out. You know, like everything, it was, you know, a journey that took a lot longer than I had hoped. It took me a long time to write my first book. I didn't know how to write a book. My first book was Tie the Modern Fairy Tale, and it took me probably about 6 years to write it. I had no idea what plot was. I had, you know, spent a lot of early drafts with a lot of elves sitting around on couches experiencing ennui and drinking coffee. And so, you know, I had to figure out all that stuff.
You didn't know how to write a book.
I didn't know how to write a book until I wrote one.
How have you come up with this alternative universe filled with zombies and fairies and monsters? What is that mental process like?
Well, I mean, each book is different. And, you know, a lot of times I go into it with a premise and a character and also some kind of image that, you know, which evokes a feeling. And you know how when you go in and to the hairdresser and they pull a piece of your hair up and they cut against that hair, you know, they pull that as the measuring stick. For me, that image is the heart of the book, and I have to measure everything I come up with against it. And, you know, no matter how many times I think I have a plan, what's most important is whether or not it feels like the book I wanted it to feel like when I started.
Now, did you start your first book with that approach, or is that something that you learned in the process?
It's definitely something I learned in the process. I mean, you know, when I started my first book, I just really wanted it to sound like a book, you know, and I didn't even know quite what that meant. You know, it's about a girl discovering that she is a fairy changeling, and you know, I had some of the beginning, but I changed so much of it over the drafts because, you know, I think the hardest thing when you start writing is that you're a much better reader than you are a writer.
Mm.
And I knew it didn't sound right. I knew it wasn't good yet, but I didn't know how to make it good. And, you know, just revising it and revising it and revising it was the only way to figure out how to make it good.
Well, can you do research on this kind of, I mean, can you do research on zombies? I mean, have you ever tried to do that? Is there any correlation with the real world that you explored in this process?
Well, first of all, I have to be very clear. I do not write about zombies because I really am terrified of zombies. I'm actually super terrified of zombies.
Hmm.
Well, only vampires.
Well, arguably, they don't really exist, Holly. I mean,
this is not, even when people make the moaning sound, when they put out their arms, I don't like anything about it. They smell, they decay. I don't like, blah.
Not a big fan of
all other undead. I like all the other undead. Ghosts, revenants, ghouls. Not a zombie.
But zombie, you're just not there for the zombies.
Not there.
We had the chance to talk with some teens in our area who are fans of yours. Here is Megan Graybill. She's a 14-year-old who goes to Okemos High School, who is pretty excited about your coming to town. Here she is.
I'm just really excited that you're actually going to answer my question, because I get the way other people get about, like, movie stars. I'm just so starstruck by the fact that there's authors in the same town that I am in. It's just really exciting.
Holly, are you hearing that a lot on your book tour?
You know, sometimes. Sometimes I go to towns where actually they get a lot of authors through, but I completely identify with that because that is how I felt. I never met an author when I was a kid. I assumed that authors were dead once I got there, but, you know, I didn't have any sense that they were alive to, you know, at the time that I was and writing, and was super excited the first time I met an author.
Well, what is that like to be that person now?
You know, it's great to be that person because I can relate to it and I can talk about it, and, you know, I can talk to especially young writers about what it's like to actually go and do this for a living. And it's great, actually, to be a writer because I get to meet other writers, which I have been starstruck by, and have an excuse to talk to them.
Holly, when you were young, what authors did you want to meet?
Well, I was a really huge Lloyd Alexander reader. I don't know if you remember the Prydain Chronicles, the Black Cauldron, Book of Three, and a big Madeline L'Engle fan. I would have loved to meet either one of those. And I actually know people who have called. I've met other writers who called Lloyd Alexander, but I would never. That seems so intimidating to me, but they called him, and apparently he gave them a lot of advice.
Did you end up meeting either of these?
I've never met either one of them.
Oh, you got some unfinished business as a fan. Here is another question from Megan Graybill.
I'm Megan Graybill. I'm 14 years old, and I go to Okemos High School. And I was wondering, where do you find the titles for your books? And I was also wondering if you had any advice for young writers when it comes to sticking with a story and developing it fully.
What do you think, Holly?
Well, I think for me, a lot of times I have a title that's sort of a working title, and I come to love it, and I wind up sticking with it. So I don't have the greatest. A lot of times I actually am somewhat not sure whether I like my titles or, you know, I go back and forth on them. The Coldest Girl in Cold Town is actually my favorite title, and it came from a short story that I wrote. So I find them different places. But in terms of sticking with a story, I think the hardest thing is there's points when you know something has gone wrong. And one of the things that you have to decide is, am I going to push on through to the end, or am I going to figure out what exactly I did that I don't like and fix it? And I think that's a very personal decision. A lot of times I do go back and I don't push on. However, I know that for different people it works differently. And so the best thing you can do is, you know, figure out if you feel like I can't go on with this, that's okay. Then sit down and figure out why and what has gone wrong, and then you will be able to move forward through the story.
But what role do your editors play in this process?
Usually an editor will get a completed manuscript. Usually they will not actually have a partial manuscript and talk through it with you. However, you can call your editor in a panic, and sometimes they will, you know, they will talk you through where you are and where you're stuck. Talk you off the ledge, exactly. And also, you know, you may find that you can create a community of friends who are also writers who will help you in that way, where you can call them and say, this thing isn't working. Can you help me? You know, can we talk this through?
And a friend of Megan has a question for you, too.
I'm Allison Brasky. I'm 14 years old, and I go to Okemos High School. And my question is, if you could pick a different genre besides fantasy, which genre would you pick to write in and why?
What do you think, Holly?
A tough call. I've been reading and writing fantasy pretty much my whole life, and the reason I write it is because I love it so much. I do love mystery. I love noir. You know, I wrote a magical mobster series. And so I wouldn't mind trying my hand at that. And I wouldn't mind writing some science fiction, although I'm not sure that I know enough yet to do that. But I wouldn't mind trying.
When you work, do you work on multiple projects at once, or do you focus on one?
I try to work on one. Sometimes deadlines interrupt that. Sometimes I've promised to write a short story for someone, and I need to do that. But for the most part, I try and work on one thing until I'm done with it.
Your online bio says you live in a house with a secret library.
That's true.
Tell us about that.
Well, So there is this website. It's called hiddendoors.com. And I was able to buy from them a door that looks like a bookshelf. And I put it in front of the door to my library. And so you cannot tell that my library is there. And it's fantastic.
Just like in the movies.
And you can have one too.
Just like in the movies.
Absolutely.
Oh, my gosh.
I like it so much. But it is really just you can order this door and it will come to you. And then you can get someone to install it. And then you, too, will have a secret room.
That is so interesting. Any plans for new books in the future? How far into the future do you think?
I try to think a couple books out. Right now, I'm working on a fairy YA book called The Darkest Part of the Forest that's going to be out in January 15, and I'm co-writing a middle grade series with my buddy Cassandra Clare, and the first book of that, The Iron Trail, will be out in fall 2014.
Very interesting. Holly Black is author of the new book, The Coldest Girl in Coal Town. Holly will be at the Lansing Mall Wednesday at 7 and at the Meridian Mall in Okemos Thursday at 7 p.m. Holly, thank you so much for talking with us and good luck.
Thank you so much.
And now, Current State's book reviewer Scott Southard offers his take on Holly Black's new novel for young adults, The Coldest Girl in Coal Town.
I have never understood the whole vampire thing, and that's apart from my extreme personal distaste of them, which I will get to later. If an alien was to rocket past our planet and spy just a fraction of our entertainment, they would think we are taken over by the undead. They are everywhere. Books, TV, movies, you can't escape them, and it seems a lot of us wouldn't want to anyway. In Holly Black's latest young adult novel, The Coldest Girl in Coal Town, the author has entered the fray with her own sharpened fangs ready. Being a story of vampires filled with teenagers and very old vampires that look like teenagers, the book's unable to avoid that comparison with Twilight. Luckily, Black manages to get through that unfortunate comparison unscathed, creating a work far superior to that surprisingly popular series. One of the reasons The Coldest Girl is so much better than Twilight lies in the main character of Tana. While in Twilight, Bella's life seems only to revolve around winning the heart of her vampire, even going so far as to attempt suicide to catch his attention. That is not the case with Tana. She is strong, independent, and doesn't change for anyone else, nor does she want to. This seems to make her the only lead in a vampire tale that doesn't want to join the immortals. Good for her. If I had to point to an influence for this novel, I would first gravitate towards Anne Rice's Vampire Chronicles, especially the earlier books where you had the clash of the old and the new vampires. The vampires in this tale, like in Rice's books, have names just made for being mysterious and gothic. For example, Lucin, Elizabeth, and Gavril. And also, like Rice, some of them dare to even enjoy being vampires. Where Rice's Lestat became a rock star, Black's Lucin is the host of a television show, a broadcast of a nonstop party in the heart of a cold town. The only problem I had with this book is I don't understand its categorization as a young adult novel, beyond the abundance of teenagers in it. Consider that the book begins with Tana waking up in a bathtub with a hangover the morning after a wild party, then discovering she is the only survivor of a massacre. We read as she steps carefully over the corpses of friend after friend until finally discovering her ex-boyfriend tied to a bed with puncture marks and a vampire in chains next to him. This book is filled with violent imagery like this, with bodies always about to be stabbed or bitten into. No one is safe. The only thing this book doesn't have is nudity and swearing, which is odd because if I was Tana, I would have been swearing a lot during this adventure. So is this the line we draw in the sand these days for young adult literature? Really? Swearing is that big a deal? Whatever the case, I walked away thinking how tame Harry Potter and Narnia are in comparison. Yes, I think Aslan would have been shocked by this book. Dumbledore's death have nothing on the physical destruction in these pages. A parent might want to check this book out first before deciding to hand it to their younger readers. In this book's reality, vampires are part of the society and have been quarantined into areas called coal towns. While some would consider them prisons to be avoided, many of the young find them hypnotic, as TV shows and the news regularly broadcast the happenings inside the walls. Over the course of the novel, we follow Tana, the vampire Gavril, and her ex-boyfriend as they make the trip to a coal town. When they finally arrive, Tana falls into the middle of a vampire civil war, where it is not clear to her, or to us the readers, who the good guys are, or if there are any good guys. And while at the end we are uncertain of Tana's fate, it doesn't beg for a sequel, and that's a nice change in young adult literature, and one I applaud. The Coldest Girl in Coal Town is a book for late evenings filled with shadows and thunderstorms in the distance, perfect as we get closer to October. And while it won't surprise on every page, it will still make you jump from time to time. Oh, and why do I dislike vampires so much? Well, they drink blood, and that's just gross. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
Scott Southard is the author of two new novels, A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Standforth in the Case of the Dangerous Dare. Scott's writing on a variety of topics can also be found online at sdsouthard.com. His blog is called The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. And once again, you can catch author Holly Black at the Barnes & Noble in the Lansing Mall tonight at 7 p.m. She'll also be at Schuller Books in Okemos tomorrow night. That's also at 7 p.m. That's Current State for Wednesday. Coming up on Thursday on our program, 35 years ago, teacher John Hunter put all the problems facing the world onto a 4x5 wooden board and asked his fourth graders to solve them. And for the past three decades, they have. John Hunter joins us tomorrow to discuss his geopolitical simulation, The World Peace Games. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks as well to producer Emmanuel Berry and Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Take care.